Maboff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. The Magic Castle in Los Angeles is a mecca for magicians, a private club for conjurers and illusionists to share their secrets, swap stories, and refine their art. On this week's show, magician and Magic Castle board member Rob Zabrecki takes me on a virtual tour of the Gothic Mansion high in the Hollywood Hills as he dishes the dirt on everyone from the piano-playing ghost in the downstairs bar to the club's celebrity members such as Di Vernon and Neil Patrick Harris. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. Rob, I had the pleasure of watching you perform recently at the Melbourne Magic Festival, and I loved your unique style of performing in that you were obviously an amazing magician, but you had this incredible mix of being a little bit old-fashioned, but at the same time in a way in which I don't think I've ever seen before, a little bit camp, but at the same time a little bit creepy. And I was thinking afterwards that it reminded me a little bit of the Magic Castle itself. The Magic Castle is, it's a little bit creepy, but it's a little bit camp and a little bit kitsch. Is that a fair description of the Magic Castle, do you think? And of you, I suppose.
It's a great description of both of us. I mean, there's a lot of ideas that have gone into both of those things, the Magic Castle and my performing persona and material choices and all that stuff. So yeah, that's a nice compliment. I mean, I was refer to the architecture of the Magic Castle is kind of Frankenstein architecture, because they've taken bits and pieces from different eras, primarily, you know, Victorian and Edwardian times, some Art Nouveau, some Art Deco, but it's really a kind of Victorian themed mansion. It just has weird bits of molding that don't match with one another, and track lighting over here, and a poster from the 70s here, and a turn of the century lithograph of Cheng Ling Su over there. And, you know, it's this nice hodgepodge that, when you look at it all together, it sort of looks seamless. But if you break it into each component, you say these things don't really go together. And I think that could easily be said about my performance style.
Okay. Oh, good. So, how did that building end up existing? Because it's set in the Hollywood Hills, and most of the buildings around there are some old buildings, but they're old by Los Angeles standards, which is not really sort of ancient. And yet, this building feels a lot older than it is.
It was built in 1908. The thing about Hollywood 1908 you have to first consider is that this is before silent film. So this is before Hollywood really existed. In 1908, Hollywood wasn't much more than a desert with some banks and orange groves. You know, the landscape was very, very different. And there was a street, Franklin Avenue, that hosted a bunch of private residents. And the Lane Mansion, the house was built for a man called Roland B. Lane, who was...
Lane, L-A-N-E.
L-A-N-E, yes,
oh,
correct.
I'm sorry. I thought you said Wayne Mansion, as in where Batman lives, and I got a little bit excited.
No, not that cool.
Okay.
But cool in its own way. so it was built as this private residence for this man and his family, and he was, a very successful banker in the Hollywood era. Well, that all changed as Hollywood became more popular. The house, you know, stayed very valuable, and he lived there until the 30s. So by the 30s, Hollywood was certainly built up, and movies came in by the 20s and, you know, definitely well-established into the 30s. At that point, he moved out, and the house itself became like a duplex, and then later it became like an apartment complex. And some say it was, for a short period, a brothel, a whorehouse. Much truth is in that or not, but it sure sounds interesting to say and consider, you know.
It does have that feel about it. It certainly it does have a burlesque boudoir vibe to it.
That's true, but I'll get to the architecture, because all those things were all added in later. So what had happened is, by the late 1950s, you have this house that has been stripped down of all of its the exterior of the house still looked like a Victorian mansion, but inside everything had been painted. All the wood had been painted several times. Several of the big rooms were made into smaller rooms, and it was really divided into this kind of low rent living, you know, a place to kind of just be, because otherwise it was going to be torn down and there was no use for, you know, a big mansion of that sort in the late 50s. Well, in come these two brothers who were writing for television at the time on Hollywood and Highland, which is very close to Hollywood and Vine, right in the heart of Hollywood. And their father had a dream to start a magic club in Hollywood. their father was a magician. They were from Pasadena, which from an affluent family, which Pasadena is very kind of a couple cities over from Hollywood, but it's a very nice little city, nice little neighborhood. And their father had this dream to start this magic club. Well, as they're writing for this TV show, they look down from their office and they can see this mansion, this decaying mansion in Hollywood. And one of the brothers had the idea, and they said, you know what? I think that's the spot where Dad wanted us to have the magic club. So they knocked on the door, and at that point, the person who owned the property, which wasn't Roland B. Lane because he had passed many years before, but a man called Thomas Glover said, yeah, you know what? I'd be happy to turn this place, do something different with this place. It's just barely hanging on by a thread. So in 1963, January 2nd, 1963, the Magic Castle was born. And it became the premier clubhouse for magicians and the clubhouse for the Academy of Magical Arts. And the family, and it was the Larson family, which is, we're talking about Milt Larson and his brother Bill Larson and his wife Irene Larson. It was the three of them. And they just did everything they could to make this place a hit on the magic scene, and it really instantly was.
What do you think attracted magicians to it? Magic clubs have been around for many years prior to the Magic Castle, but what was it about the castle that struck a chord?
I think at first, the idea that there was a place for magicians to go, I don't know that it was open 7 nights a week originally, but it was certainly open 5 nights a week. And the fact that there was a place to go, and it was a Victorian mansion nonetheless, this wasn't in the lobby of a hotel or in a cafeteria at a church where they were, you know, having AA meetings where sometimes people have, you know, magic meetings. This was a, you know, veritable mansion. And here it is now, suddenly it's the Magic Castle. It's branded as this place where people can go and have, a, you know, they can see close-up magic and stage magic and parlor magic. And they've got a dress up. There's a dress code. And I would also add that this is in Hollywood, California in the early 1960s. Well, Hollywood's certainly booming at this point, and people wanted to go to an exclusive nightclub. So, A, to go to an exclusive nightclub was important for a lot of people, but B, a private magic club, well, that was something else. So immediately, you have the magic community at large in L.A., everyone's flocking there, and celebrities, people are going there because it's the cool place to be.
One of the issues you get with magic clubs in general is they do tend to disappear in on themselves and become more about the members. But it sounds like the Magic Castle was also focused on, despite being a private club, was very much about putting on shows that people could watch.
That's absolutely true, and that can be 100% credited to the Milt Larson for this idea of creating this fantastic magic club where people could come and appreciate magic and look at posters and get together and really enjoy each other's company in an absolutely marvelous setting. You know, Milt was all about the aesthetic of it. He built the place, where Bill, his brother, his older brother, was more about the business end of things and kind of kept the books going and, you know, made sure that the doors were kept open. But Milt created this completely cool space that still pretty much looks like it did when it opened in, you know, in 63. So there's, you know, you add up all these things and you go, oh yeah, this is great. Now that said, it hasn't always done great. There's been times where the club's been in a lot of financial trouble and we've almost lost it and the land was almost sold and, you know, this and that. So there was a fire in 2011. It hasn't gone without its fair share of drama.
Can we make a sort of a virtual tour? There's a lot to go through and a lot of rooms and a lot of secret passages and sure, different places. But just for someone who's never been there.
Imagine pulling your car off a street in sunny California where there's palm trees lining the streets and there's billboards of the latest movies that are coming out and, you know, fashion models are on each street corner and there's people with their cameras looking for Brad Pitt. You know, and that's a typical street corner in Hollywood. So make a couple of turns and pull up a steep driveway, and suddenly you're facing this Victorian mansion that's massive. And there's the sign, the Magic Castle. And people that don't know what it is, that's all they're getting. What the hell is the Magic Castle? And then you go and you knock on the door and you go, how do I come in here? And there's a bodyguard the door saying, you don't, because you're not a member.
I remember waiting for someone because I'm not a member, and so I waited out the front in my holiday suit, you know, the suit that had been stuffed in my bag for the last 2 weeks because I knew I needed dress code to get in, and a bevy of beautiful women and mysterious magicians all walked past me and swung their way in as I was waiting for my contact, and I felt like perhaps if I took a wrong turn, you know, I was going to be disappeared.
Yes, you'd be back on the street with all those folks looking for Brad Pitt and staring at those big billboards.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing. So if you are invited to be, you know, to come to the club or are a member of the club, you get the glorious joy of going into a very interesting Victorian style lobby that's very dimly lit, where there's usually, you know, a nice girl at the front desk who will kind of check you in, and then you're facing a series of bookcases, and she'll ask you to turn to one of them and say a magic word. And once that magic word is said, I won't tell you how, but you suddenly gain access to getting into the club. And it's fantastic. And I've been going there since 96 actually, but a member since 98. And every time I go, I look forward to that little moment. It creates the perfect little moment to go into a special club like that.
I think it's got that sense of tradition and history and ritual and mystery and all those things that people expect from magic, is that you don't just kind of wander in a couple of glass doors and you're in the club. There's a process that you need to go through to get in.
And a dress code, you know, for men, it's coat and tie. There are no jeans and no sneakers are accepted. For women, it's cocktail attire, and pantsuits are acceptable. But even if you're wearing, you know, $500 Prada jeans and, you know, Gucci sneakers, they don't care.
No,
that means nothing to them, and they'll loan you clothes to sort of fit in with every, you know, to fit the dress code. But it's very, very strict, and it always has been strict. And I think it's one of the things that keeps the club as amazing as it is, because you look around the place and everyone's dressed up. Therefore, most people, and I can't not, and certainly not everybody, but most people are on their best behavior. When you're dressed up, you tend to give a little more of a shit.
You know? You do, like, yeah. All right. Great is that because it's magicians as well, there's so many magicians, and when you say to a magician, dress up, they don't put on their gray suit and black tie and white shirt and, you know, silver tie clip. They dress up, and that you see, you know, top hats and morning coats and people in like full white suits. And I love it, like the on the website, the dress code specifies that you can wear a leather suit if you want, which is, you know, the kind of classic 90s magician look. At the same time as them giving you this restriction, there's also this sense of, but have fun with it.
That's the whole thing. It's like, you know, my whole take on it is once you get in the Magic Castle, it should be fantastic. And you should just let go of reality. And, you know, a little bit of fantasy is welcomed in there, because the rest of the day you're spent in life with everybody else. And that's, you know, so that's kind of boring. So you enter the club and you enter this, a very large bar area called the Grand Salon. And the Grand Salon is the main meeting place of the club. There's actually seven cash bars throughout the Magic Castle, but the Grand Salon is the main bar. And when you're in there and you step in this, it's dimly lit. And there are two things you notice right off the bat. Number one, the first thing you notice is by way of hearing the sound of a live piano. And it's our resident piano player, Invisible Irma, who plays the requests of the guests. And she plays throughout the night. There's a live piano accompaniment to sort of go along with your initial experience there, which is always pretty cool because it just feels warm. You feel like you're in somebody's living room.
It is. Just to clarify, that means you go into a room and there is a piano sitting there that is playing itself, and you can talk to Irma, and she will respond via the piano.
She's a great listener, and if you request, you know, say a Beatles song, there's a very good chance you'll hear that Beatles song, or a Gershwin song, or maybe some soft hit from the 1970s or something. She's got a great repertoire of songs.
My host, because I'm an Australian, said, well, we want to choose an Australian song, and the only Australian song that they could think of off the top of their head was Waltzing Matilda, which is an Australian, the Australian folk song. Irma knew it.
I'm impressed that someone called out Waltzing Matilda. I would have called out like a NXS song or Midnight Oil.
Midnight Oil, yes. I would have been very impressed if she could. I don't even know if you can play Midnight Oil songs on the piano, but if anyone could, it would be Irma.
That's right, and she seems to know all. So there's this. So the Irma's there to kind of, you know, warm up, to kind of give. There's a certain warmth, I think, that just the live piano, you know, provides. And then there's a bunch of lantern slides, these small glass slides that are lit from the back that used to be projected in silent movie houses with little advertisements. So they look like little. It looks like stained glass, basically. And in a way, it is stained glass, but there's these small little sort of 4x4-inch glass slides that are beautifully lit up, and they're little pictures of, you know, advertisements for Coca-Cola or certain silent films or a starlet who's coming in, you know, coming up for her opening role in a movie. So they're all kind of backlit and kind of line some of the walls of the bar there. If you go to the left, there's the famous close-up gallery where some of the finest magicians of the world will perform close-up acts from 5:30 at night till, God, 1 in the morning. I think the last show was like 12:30, 12:45 or something. So every 40 minutes, there's a 20-minute close-up show. And the close-up gallery holds 22 people, and every show is generally packed in with people dying to see, you know, your coins, your cups, your cards, you know, your tributes to Di Vernon, people doing the latest versions of any close-up, you know, some really cutting-edge stuff and sometimes just, you know, some classic magic.
But this is a room that was built and designed for close-up magicians and audiences wanting to watch it. It's got the raked seating and the table can be sort of moved and adjusted so that everyone can see. And it's one of the most enjoyable ways I've ever watched close-up magic in my life, just purely because of the design of the room.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It was designed for close-up magic. And originally in the Lane Mansion, it was the piano room. So that was where there was a Victorian little settee in there and a baby grand piano lived in that room when the Lane family lived there. But as it became the castle, it seemed like a good spot for the close-up room. So, and it's small. It holds, like I said, yeah, like I mentioned, it holds 22 people. But because it's raked, the room, you know, the room itself is, the seating's raked. It feels a little bit bigger, and it's got these little Victorian touches everywhere, and there's sort of red velvet curtains, and the light. There's this light settings are amazing, and there's a host comes in and introduces the show, and there's, you know, a bartender will come in and take drink orders, and really it's set perfectly. If you're a close-up magician with a solid act, it is the ideal room to play, I would say.
But it's not the only theater. Is there four theaters, is that right? Four?
Yeah, so that's to the left, and then you go up if you go up to the right, there's this absolutely stunning staircase that's got some gargoyle railing, this large gargoyle, heavily carved railing that takes you upstairs to the restaurant. So there's a restaurant that seats 200 people per seating, and there's three seatings a night. So it's a very large restaurant that overlooks Hollywood Boulevard, kind of Hollywood and Hollywood Boulevard, and the famous Roosevelt Hotel. It's the best. Beyond the restaurant is the Houdini Seance Room, where a couple times a week, seances are held to contact the spirit of Harry Houdini.
And does he respond?
He sometimes does. There's three spirit mediums that conduct the seances, and I'm one of them. Quite often, someone comes back. We're never sure if it's Houdini or not, but
he did say that he would try. He said if there is life after death, then he would try and come back. So
if anybody could do it, it'd be him.
Yeah, and if he was going to visit any place, no better place than the Magic Castle.
But it's a wonderful small little room. It holds about 13 people. It's a circular table, and you can dine in there. And the room is loaded with Houdini memorabilia. There are ephemera, there's letters, some of the types of shackles he would escape from, his straitjacket, his original metamorphosis trunk, milk can escape, and a series of personal effects from he and his, you know, wife and assistant of 32 years, Bessie.
There is a Disneyland vibe to the whole castle, but because of the age of it and the, as you said, the fact that it's kind of the Frankenstein nature of it, It's just doesn't quite have the sheen and the gloss of a Disneyland Haunted Mansion ride, and so it feels like this is what a real Haunted Mansion would feel like, and
there's that element where things just a little bit off, where at Disneyland where you can't really reach out and really touch anything, but the Magic Castle you can. So and people do, so there is that element where you're in someone's home. So at this point, once you exit the restaurant, you walk down a very large hall called the Wall of Fame, and there's a bunch of framed photographs and posters from magicians from every era. There's you'll see it might be like a Blackstone lithograph next to a painting of Milt Larson, and then next to that there might be like an oil painting of Di Vernon or something like that. So it's really got this great variety of, like, people that don't go to the Magic Castle would have a great appreciation for magic. They just go, wow, look at all this. They can see that there's a love for the craft and the art form and the history of it just from sort of walking through the halls, because it just commands a reverence just by what's there, you know. Once you walk down this little the Wall of Fame there, you end up in an area that was built in 1977. So in 1975, they realized the club was becoming more popular, and they decided to add on to the actual house itself. So at this point, the Magic Castle actually became three times bigger on the inside than it was on the outside. What they'd done was they brought in some tractors. They dug into the mountain, and they added a couple of showrooms. And they used the previous parking garage, and they turned it into what's now known as the Palace of Mystery. Did you get a chance to go in there?
I did, yeah.
Right. So that was the former parking garage, but now disguised as a 125-seat showroom for our largest, our stage magicians.
And that did feel quite surreal, having looked at the outside of the building and got a sense of it in space, and then suddenly finding this reasonable size theater for stage magic in what felt like the middle of the building was quite disorientating.
Yeah, everyone's shocked when they go in there, because they're like, how can this all fit in this house, which is big, but it's not that big. And the reason is because they're sitting in the parking garage, and the two sort of pillars that are on either side of the stage are literally cement pillars that were there since the 30s, and they just decided to build a stage around them and enclose it and bring in bits and pieces of buildings that were being torn down in Hollywood. So at this point, in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of construction going on in Los Angeles, and Milt Larson was the first one to get a pickup truck and get some of his buddies and drive to these places that were being torn down, whether it was an old church or an Elks Lodge or God knows what, any, small business that was being, taken away, and said, hey, can we take these fixtures? Can we use this molding? Can we have this tin wall paneling? And he took all these items and repositioned them in the club, which hence creating the architecture, Frankenstein architecture I was telling you about. So that's kind of how the palace areas is all been assembled, is through all these things that Milt had acquired over the years.
Is there a dog in the background?
Yeah, can you hear him?
I just heard the.
that's my dog Chase. He's helping me with the interview.
Just as those words came out of my mouth, I went, I hope there's a dog in the room.
No, I'm creepy, but not that creepy.
So where to next? I think my favorite place is the W.C. Fields Bar.
Yeah. So you come out of the Palace of Mystery, you step into the parlor area. Well, the parlor area is particularly fascinating because outside of the parlor is a real shrine to Di Vernon, and there's oil paintings and photographs and more ephemera, documents and things that were sort of important to his career, all line this area outside of the parlor.
I guess would be best described as the father of modern close-up magic, and was a fixture at the Magic Castle for many years.
Exactly, and some of those people that he helped out were Ricky Jay, John Carney, great American magician, Bruce Servan, Mike Caveney, and Doug Henning. So he was somebody who was really an important figure in the lives of a lot of these magicians who were seeking his counsel, but also just admiring his work as this, you know, super genius in the field.
There's a fantastic book, I believe it's called The Magician and the Card Cheat, from memory, which is about him and his obsession with card cheating. And it's a fantastic look at the life of Di Vernon and exactly what type of man he was, and also the world of card cheating and him trying to hunt down Alan Kennedy, who was one of the first people to perfect a center deal.
That's right, the famous center deal. What a great story. Vernon's just, you know, the more I get into magic and the longer I've been into magic.
Is it true that his ashes are held at the castle? Is that correct?
I have heard that. I've never opened the box and looked inside. So
good. It's a cigar box. Is that right?
It is. And it, even if I did open it, and there was ashes in there, I wouldn't be able to tell if they were Vernon's or not.
you'd smell them and go, yep, nope, that's definitely Vernon. Yeah, or you'd open them and your face would melt off like Raiders of the Lost Ark. It would be.
I'm not doing that.
You don't want to risk it. Definitely not. So where to next?
The Parlor is a great showroom. It holds about 50 people. It's also raked. It's got a little backstage area. You come out through a red velvet curtain. It's got a little sound system in there, and it's for the stand-up performers that are doing, you know, 20-minute shows. So you come out of the Parlor, you go downstairs, and then you're in the W.C. Fields Bar. That's where now we're in the area known as the Inner Circle, and the Inner Circle is sort of a nod to Magic Circle and some of the famous London hotspots from kind of vaudeville basically vaudeville days. So Inner Circle is a great meeting spot for magicians. It's a really big area, and it hosts number one, the W.C. Fields Bar, which is kind of a large bar that you can see like some of the best bar magicians perform at.
Yeah.
Get a cocktail, and then either from there you can go into – there's another – yet one last theater, the Peller Theater, which holds about 40 people. And was particularly notable for launching the show that was performed by Derek Delgadio and Helder Guimaraes at the Geffen Theater in Los Angeles, and then it went on to New York off Broadway for several months. But this great Peller Theater is a really nice little tight theater where on the weekends the entertainment director hooks up two magicians. And each magician does about 20 minutes, but they're not asked to, but it's suggested that the act somehow integrate one way or another. So if we were going to work together, we might write a little intro, or you might be doing a trick. I could come and interrupt you and come up with, you know, do like a little. There's some sketch elements to what happens in there,
and that's something
it can range from amazing to terrible.
And that's something you don't really see very much in the magic community. Magicians do tend to be solo performers, or if they do work with other performers, they tend to be assistants, you know, people that they can kind of use as props. It's very rare that you get two magicians of equal standing willing to work together, and when they do, it can be amazing. I mean, it's obviously why we have Penn and Teller and you know, great performers like that. So I think it's fantastic that the castle is kind of encouraging solo performers to work together.
I completely agree, and it's really designed for the performers who are, I would say, seasoned and that have, you know, an act down so well that they know, okay, I can do a couple of tricks and then I can maybe do a pick a card trick with another magician and we can sort of get together on a piece and do a little improvisation or this and that. So it's always really interesting to see who works together and how well it works together.
I was talking to Pop Hayden, who was saying that his new magnetic water performance, that he ran that in at the castle. And so him, obviously, he's a veteran performer of decades and a seven-time award winner at the castle. So he's a great performer, but it also has given him a venue to try out things which are new and different.
The general public goes, oh, you know, magicians, they can just do stuff. But we know that every bit of, you know, whatever that stuff is, you know, hours and years and, you know, this is a lifetime of work in some cases.
Okay, so is there anywhere left? I mean, there's obviously lots of, as you said, nooks and crannies, but that is the lion's share of the...
No, there's one. So now, geez, we've gone through the whole thing. The last thing is the William Larson Senior Library.
Oh, of course.
Yes, which hosts thousands of books, hundreds of hours of videotape, and a great librarian named Bill Goodwin, who can point you in the direction of whatever you're looking for with a wonderful database. So you could spend a week in there just research the gypsy thread, for example, or the cups and balls or whatever, you know, the shrinking cards. The library itself is great because there's all these magicians and they're working on material, and you'll see the guys in, you know, working in the mirrors doing a, you know, French drop over here, and it's cool, you know. It's, you go in there and if you love magic, you kind of can't believe what you're looking at, because it's just the thing about the Magic Castle and the Academy of Magical Arts is it's aimed to be an environment that's friendly and encouraging. And for the most part, that's what we have. Those are that comprises the majority of the membership. We've got over 5,000 members. So, you know, not, again, as I said, not all magicians are created equal. There's some people are, you know, more difficult to get along with others, and there is drama, and there is what some people consider cliques and, you know, different types of magicians, and that's which would probably exist in any club. But generally, it's a warm, friendly environment. And when I go there, I try to remind myself of that, because when I was starting to go there, there were so many magicians that were warm and friendly to me that when people ask me for help or, you know, about anything, I just try to be as open and friendly as possible.
Neil Patrick Harris is probably the most famous member of the club?
Absolutely. Neil did great things for the Academy of Magical Arts, primarily because he was president at a time when the club was gaining popularity and would go on major network television shows and talk about the club in a really positive way. He was also president when we had the fire. So in 2011, Halloween, club roof goes up on flames. It was unbelievable. And there was Neil, you know, kind of as the voice of the club, you know, telling everybody that it was going to be okay. And, you know, basically helped rebuild the club in a really great way.
Who's the current president of the club?
The current president is Erica Larson, who is the daughter of Bill Jr. So one of the founders of the club, Irene and Bill, it's Erica, is the daughter of them, and she is incredible. She's great. She has a great zest for celebrating magic. She's warm and friendly and encouraging to all the members, and we couldn't have a better president. She's the best.
What was your introduction to the club? For people who don't know, we're originally a musician, and in the indie rock band Possum Dixon in the 90s, and then you became a magician.
Well, I'll see if I can give you the shortest version of the story, but I did not like magic as a kid. I had no interest in it whatsoever. And I was in Baltimore, Maryland in the mid-90s, in the very middle of summer. It was a hot day. And I saw a magic shop, and only because it had an air conditioner, I decided to go inside. And I ducked in. I cooled off. I felt guilty for not buying anything after a while. And after a few minutes, I was shown a trick by the man who worked there. And he vanished a handkerchief. And I was floored. I couldn't believe what I had just seen. It was a miracle. So I performed the trick that night on stage with my band, but I swapped out the handkerchief for a wrapped condom for some reason. I just decided, hey, it's got a wrapped condom. It was a throwaway gag. It was just like a moment where a guitar player had to tune his guitar. And so I decided to fumble around with this little trick that I picked up at the magic shop. So after performing that trick, I had a little epiphany. I thought it was a really cool little thing to do on stage, and it was fun. And I'd seen this man vanish this handkerchief. I just thought it was so beautiful that by the end of the tour, I came home back to L.A., other side of the country, and my girlfriend, who is now my wife, had a pass to go to the Magic Castle. And we went up one night, and we walked in together and literally fell in love with magic and the subculture of magic and the history of magic, the performances we had seen. Everything about it was just, I just knew that I needed to reinvent myself as a magician.
Has that affected your style of performing, in that you went from being an entertainer and a performer on stage and an artist on stage to, you know, obviously being a different type of entertainer and artist on stage, and you did it through this place unlike any other sort of magic environment in the world? Do you think that's made you into the unique performer that you are today?
People tell me that's probably true. I can't tell, because it's me, you know. For me, it just seems like that's my path. So it's hard for me to analyze, like, it being any other way, you know. I talk to other magicians and see magicians all the time who perform since they were kids, and there's a certain quality to a lot of those shows that they have because they've been performing since they were kids, and because I came at it from left field in a very abstract kind of way. I think that's probably really, you know, seems to be true. Coming into the magic world, I do have a certain unique spin to what I do.
If people would like to visit the Magic Castle and they are not a magician or a member of the club, what is the best way to get their hands on a pass to experience the magic firsthand?
The best way to go to the Magic Castle is to know a member, or know someone who knows a member, and somehow find that member and tell them you want to go and see if they can, you know, send you a pass. You have to know somebody, and you got to be invited. So you need to get an invitation.
That just makes it more alluring for people, I think. Well, as soon as you tell them, you know, it's not easy, I think you just make people want to come to the club even more.
Oh my God, of course. Yeah.
Brilliant. I always finish up with the Con Man's Dictionary. So I'm going to give you a turn of phrase related vaguely to the world of, it could be magic, con artistry, scams, and then you have to do your best to try and define it. But I have a feeling you may know this one, as we touched on it briefly in our chat. So what is turning tables? Turning tables.
Turning tables is a term that was introduced by the mediums in the late 1800s, early 1900s, by spirit mediums. And they were, the mediums, of course, used this term as tables would. More than one leg would rise up off the ground and sometimes levitate high into the air.
That is absolutely spot on.
Is it? Are you kidding?
That you got it. Was that a guess?
Oh, yes. No, that is, I thought I was going to fail, for
no,
sure.
No, that is 100%, 100% the correct answer. You answered, and you answered with such authority that I assumed that, he knows this one. No, that is absolutely 100% correct. The reason why it was so popular was because it was very, very easy to fake. There's like 1,000 different ways to make a table move, including sometimes everyone puts their hands on the table, you turn out the lights and the table starts to float, but everyone's got their hands on the table. And the reason why it's floating is that the medium has stuck their head under the table and is making it levitate via the use of their head. So it was a great way for con artist mediums to prove their abilities.
Amazing.
Congrats. I wish there was a prize, because you seem genuinely happy to have got it.
I'm just thrilled to get one question right. I usually do terribly at tests. So.
Well, there is only one question, and you got it. So 100%, well, A+. Well done.
Okay, we'll stop right there then.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for being on the podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Hey, Nicholas, I had a great time chatting with you. It was really cool meeting you, and good luck.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.